This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The year was 1992. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Alice Steinbach had a good job with the Baltimore Sun. She was a single mom. Her two sons were grown and on their own. Sitting at her kitchen table one wintry day, her cat snoozing nearby, Alice Steinbach decided, as she puts it, it was time to jump ship, to stir things up a bit. She liked her life, but she was also questioning it. She wondered if her work was, quote, not only what I did, but who I was. It seemed it was time to get away. It was time to reflect on life. It was time for renewal. So she set out for Europe. Alice Steinbach traveled on her own to France, England, Italy. She's written a lovely book about her time abroad. The title is Without Reservations, The Travels of an Independent Woman. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Alice Steinbach, this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. Our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Alice Steinbach was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 1985 while working for the Baltimore Sun. She has been a freelance writer since 1999. She is currently a Woodrow Wilson visiting fellow at Princeton. She joins us this afternoon from Chicago. Later today, she'll be in Naperville at Anderson's Bookstore, which is located at 123 West Jefferson Avenue in Naperville. That talk, question and answer session, book signing and reception is set for 7 p.m. at Anderson's this evening. Without Reservations is now available in paperback from Random House. Again, those telephone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Alice, good afternoon. Welcome. Fingers crossed, third time should be the charm, right? Alice, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and we've got a great phone connection.
Thank goodness.
Oh, wow. Did you hear my introduction?
Yes, I did, and
okay.
It was very nice.
Okay, good. Because I just wanted to kind of know, let you know where I was coming from.
Yeah.
And it would be nice to be face-to-face in a cafe this afternoon doing this interview.
Particularly with this nice weather in Chicago.
Over some coffee. How did those thoughts about work and in your life begin to percolate?
Well, actually, this book is the true story of a woman who decided to take a break because after 21 years of doing two extremely demanding jobs, one being a newspaper reporter and the other being a single mom of two sons, I was tired, frankly. My sons were out of college and on their way to their futures, and I had done a job for the Baltimore Sun that I thought was a pretty good job, and I thought it's time to take a break and to see who I became over these 21 years, because, frankly, when you're a newspaper reporter, basically your job is to forget about your life and get into the narrative of other people's lives. And I felt as though all the mothering, which I loved and still love, and all the reporting, it just made me wonder who I'd become over those 21 years when I wasn't either being a reporter or being a mother. Mm. So I wanted to find that out.
Yeah. So you made the decision to ask for a leave of absence.
Yes. Yes, I didn't at first know what to do, but I thought, how would I sort of recover some of the spontaneity and excitement and that I had when I was younger and see if I could get out in the world without any of those old labels of being someone's mother, someone's wife, someone's reporter, but just a sort of cipher, really. How could I get out there and see if I could still hack it out in the world? And I decided the best thing to do was to do something I love, which is to travel, and to do it alone. Because when you travel alone, you're really thrown back on your own, on your own resources. And I found that if I would go to just a few places, I made the decision that I would not try to do, 52 countries in 9 months, but that I would go to three or four or five places, move into some small neighborhood, and try to ingratiate myself a little bit into that culture. I had no expectations of, say, going to Paris, which was my first stop, and becoming, a friend to all the French people living there. But I did move into a little neighborhood on the left bank, into a small hotel there. It was the only reservation I had when I left, where I knew the neighborhood because I knew Paris to some extent. I know it a lot better now. There would be the baker, there would be the newsstand operator, the person who runs the florist shop, the little sandwich shop, and that I would at least have a trajectory every day, a feeling that I was in a neighborhood, and that I would sort of just go and see what happened. And this is the story of what happened.
Yeah, I imagine that a lot of listeners at this point are thinking, what a great idea. How wonderful. What a great opportunity for Alice Steinbach. But, you know, when I start to think about this, I think, a few months leave. You know, what is it like to have that much time to oneself? And for you, a journalist, you moved story to story, deadline to deadline. You know, your life, it, like many of our lives, sometimes we're just shooting down a channel.
Well, frankly, it was scary. The first day I arrived in Paris was not scary because I was so jet-lagged and so high on coffee and adrenaline. And I arrived at like 8 a.m. in the morning, and of course the nice French person behind the reservations desk informed me that my room would be ready at 3. And I hadn't slept at that point for like 22 hours. But I skipped out onto the street. I actually think I skipped all day long instead of walking. And it was just a wonderful experience. I found the little newsstand in the neighborhood. I walked up to a little cafe that I knew, and I sat there and had a wonderful omelet and a creme cafe. And then I walked around the neighborhood, and it was just a wonderful time. And the whole first day, which I describe in the book, was wonderful. And, of course, then the next day came, and that was sort of a rude shock because I had breakfast, went out onto the street, and I thought, well, now what do I do? Because I had no appointments. Like most of your listeners, and I'm sure like you, I was one of those overscheduled people. You know, 10 o'clock this meeting, 12 o'clock conference with a kid's teacher. You know, I'd go home at night at 8 o'clock, and they'd have to go to the library downtown to do some research. So I was really buried under all those kind of details that all of us get buried under in a normal life. And suddenly, I didn't have to be anywhere, which is what I thought I wanted. But it's also scary. It's like, the only thing I could tell you is it's like experiencing time as a child does again, because a child doesn't have a meeting at 10 o'clock or have to be somewhere at 3. I know they do when they go into school, but I'm talking about very young children. What you have is you have when you get hungry and when you're not hungry, when it's night, when it's day, when you're tired, when you're awake. It's a very sort of primal kind of experiencing of time. Then what do you do with it? And I thought, oh, my God, I have 9 more months of this. What am I going to do? So I devised this little scheme where every day when I left my little hotel on the left bank, I had a little list of, say, 4 places to go, Rue de Bussy, which is a wonderful outdoor market in the neighborhood, the Musée d'Orsay, which is the great museum of Impressionist work, which was about 6 blocks from my hotel. Anyway, I had this little list, and I would start in the direction of the first thing on the list, and I seldom got there because I found that if I just let myself go and followed my feet, saw an interesting street and went down it, that pretty soon it was 1 o'clock, and then I would find a little cafe somewhere and sit down and have lunch. And then it was 2:30, and then I would be walking somewhere from the cafe, and I would find a whole neighborhood that just cried out my name, you know, come down this street, come down this street. So gradually I began to trust that I could do interesting things and find interesting things to do if I just got started in the morning. After about 3 weeks, I threw the list away. Of course, I didn't need it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I remember a week I spent in San Francisco, and it was so wonderful, and having kind of a little home base.
Right.
And becoming part of the neighborhood. And I remember one of my favorite places was a little bakery, and I would walk there in the morning, and I would have a cookie and coffee or something. And near the end of the week, when I was contemplating, you know, having to leave this beautiful city and come home, and I was pretty much ready to come home, but I just loved San Francisco. Anyway, the woman who had waited on me all week in the bakery, she said, "You've been coming in here all week. Are you new in the neighborhood? Are you?
Right.
Have you moved in?"
Yeah.
And it was a great feeling.
Yeah, it is.
Some friends of yours asked when you set out, and you told them Paris was going to be your first stop. They would ask, "Why Paris?"
Well, Paris was always, I think, unconsciously in my mind as the first place to go. First of all, because I love Paris. I mean, I love the architecture and the history. It is one of those cities that is not only beautiful, but it's a city where history and the present live side by side, partly because Paris was fortunate enough not to be bombed during World War II, so you really have all the wonderful old buildings. But the French love their history, and you can be talking to very modern French people, and they will be reciting their history. They love history, so it's a very wonderful place. But the other thing is that my journalistic idol, as I made my way through the ranks of newspapers and so forth, was a woman named Janet Flanner. She's dead now. She's been dead for about 8 years, I guess. But Janet Flanner wrote something called Letter from Paris, and she wrote it for The New Yorker under the name Janet. And she wrote it for 50 years. And she started in early 1920s and went through, I think, 75 or 76, something like that. And I was such a fan. I mean, obviously, I didn't read it all that time, but the columns were, the letters all came out in paperback books. And I just loved reading about Paris because she was there when things were happening. She wrote about walking into the Café de Margaux when Picasso would come in and everybody would gather around him. It wasn't like someone who 25 years, 50 years later decides to write her memoirs and writes about remembering this. She is writing it the week it happened. So if you really want to know about that feeling of Paris, she had it. Plus, she had a wonderful writing style, which she honed as a very young woman in Paris. So the first thing I did was when I dropped my bags in my hotel, I wandered around to the hotel where I knew she had first lived in Paris, a little hotel on the Rue Bonaparte, which is still there but is much fancier now than when she lived there. And I remember walking into the hotel, and as I said, I was very high on coffee and adrenaline, and it was only like 8 o'clock in the morning at this point, if that, and this very stern French woman who was guarding the entrance to this small hotel, as they like to do in small hotels in Paris. She said, "Madame, have you business here?" And I said, "Yes, I'm meeting my friend Janet Flanner for breakfast." And she said, oh, all right, the breakfast room is in the back, and sort of waved me back there. Well, of course, you know, I'm sure she didn't know that Janet Flanner had been dead for 8 years and even who she was. But I went back and had breakfast, and I sort of had the feeling that I actually was having breakfast with Janet Flanner, and it was a great way to start the trip. Mm-hmm. So that was really part of the reason. Yeah. The other part was just Paris is so wonderful.
Yeah. Well, Janet Flanner was not your only muse on this trip. Also, there was Colette.
There was what?
Colette.
Oh, Colette.
And Freya Stark.
Oh, yes, yes.
So other women writers who traveled and wrote about the places they visited were also with you.
Yes, well, after I left Paris, I had taken this very small apartment in London on Sloane Avenue, which is different than Sloane Street. It's a little, most people know Sloane Street, which is the big shopping street. This is near there, but it was a small apartment that I had just discovered by chance, and it was wonderful and inexpensive. And I stayed in London for a fair amount of time. And, of course, in the book, part of the book is about trying to sort of tie up some loose ends in my past. I didn't really know that I was starting out to do this when I did it. And I did not start out to write a book, incidentally. I didn't write the book until 3 years after I got back from this trip in 1993. But because that would have been counter to the whole thing. I really wanted to go to get away from that, to get away from being someone, as reporters do, who observes but doesn't experience. One of the cardinal rules, as you know, is if you are reporting on something, you're not really in it. You are watching it. You are observing it and reporting on it. I wanted, and I felt I'd lost my ability to some extent to experience things. I was great at observing them and could regale people with stories about people I'd interviewed and stuff, but that my experiencing self had gotten a little rusty around the edges. So I really wanted to experience things. And so the part of the book is about that, and it's about memory. I do believe that even when you travel alone, and this is important for anyone who might be thinking about doing something like this, which I heartily recommend. Traveling alone is the greatest thing in the world. You're never lonely because people actually want to, they see you at breakfast at the hotel or where at lunch, and it's a very funny dynamic because usually couples who are traveling together, by the third day, they're sick of one another because they've never spent that much. They don't spend all day with one another at home, and they see you as sort of fresh blood, so they always invite you to have lunch with them or something, and it works out very well. But you always travel with something else when you're alone, and that is your past. And I mean that in the most positive sense. And throughout this book, as I experience things, and I tried to get back to that sort of childlike way of experiencing things, it did bring back a lot of memories of my mother and my father and growing up and of learning about my father's death and of living in London with my ex-husband when I had a 2-year-old child and seeking out the house there that we had lived in and this sort of coming to grips with some things that as you get older, you want to come to grips with. And it's not an unpleasant thing. It's really a question of maturation, I think.
Very interesting. Ella Steinbach is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a journalist. We're talking with her about her book, Without Reservations, The Travels of an Independent Woman. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. All along the way, Alice, you sent postcards to yourself. What inspired that?
Well, in 1986, I think it was, I was on an assignment in, of all places, a little island in the Baltic Sea between Denmark and Sweden, and it was called Bornholm. And it's an artist colony, but it's a very beautiful, windswept island, but it's lonely there. And I wasn't lonely while I was working. I never am. But I have to say that in the nights, I got sort of lonely. And one night, I decided to sit down and write myself a postcard. I don't know why. I just did. And I started out by saying, Dear Alice, and I just put a few thoughts down. And postcard writing is more like writing poetry than it is like writing prose because you have to squeeze a lot in a very small space. So you don't have to talk or write in complete sentences. And I signed it Love Alice. It was addressed to Dear Alice, Love Alice. Well, when I got home from that trip and the postcard arrived, it just was thrilling to me because it just was different than a journal, which I also kept. It had a certain immediacy about it. It evoked, I guess it's like Proust's Madeleines, it evoked the moment for me. So from that time on, I always send postcards to myself. In fact, I sent one to myself yesterday from Chicago. I can't wait to get home and get it. And when I was on this long trip, I sent many, many postcards to myself, sort of describing in this very sort of telegraphic, I hope, poetic way, what my thoughts and feelings were at that particular moment. And when I got home, they were all waiting for me, and that was really what prompted me to write the book. One morning, about 3 years after returning home, I got them out of one Sunday morning, a rainy Sunday morning, the kind of morning that the writer E.B. White always says, don't ever look at old photographs on a morning like that or read old letters, because you'll find it excruciatingly poignant and sad. Well, I didn't. I sat in one of my son's bedrooms with all these postcards from the trip fanned out around me, and I laughed as I read them and, felt a little sad at times, too. And I suddenly thought to myself, I wonder if I have a book here. And that was kind of the beginning of it. But I had also written a column for the Los Angeles Times and some other papers, before I took the trip, about sending postcards to oneself. And I got so much mail about that, that people saying, oh, I'm going to do that. And every time I told someone about it, they said, oh, what a wonderful idea. So I knew it had a certain appeal. But it was just a sort of accident, I suppose you could say.
It is a terrific idea. And I hope listeners will pick up on that this afternoon and think about that the next time they're traveling. We need to pause here for just a moment to bring our listeners some weather information. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of northeastern Illinois, effective until 7 o'clock this evening. Hail to 1 inch in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston. Also still in effect, a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of central Illinois until 3 o'clock this afternoon. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, this watch includes these counties in Illinois: McLean, Logan, DeWitt, Sangamon, Macon, Piatt, Moultrie, Christian, and Shelby. Stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest weather information and possible warnings. You might see some heavy weather today, Alice, in the Chicago area.
Well, you know, I've learned something. One of the many, many things I learned from traveling is that if you get too invested in whether the weather's going to be good or bad, you'll never enjoy yourself. Mm-hmm. So I always travel with a raincoat and an umbrella and whatever I think is appropriate for a certain part of the world. I'm going to a sheep farm in Scotland in about 3 weeks, and quite frankly, I'm a little flummoxed about knowing what to take there, but I think I better take knee-hip boots or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, you got to have your wellies with you.
That's right, exactly.
Well, one of the wonderful things about traveling on your own is the people that you meet. Tell us about some of the people you met. I'm thinking in particular of two women, and I could imagine myself being with the three of you, Carolyn and Vivian.
Oh, that's interesting that you should pick those two. I'm glad you did, because other people picked some of the other women. Carolyn was a young woman. The book is really about the people I met and how the influence they had on me and how they sort of, from each one I learned different things. Carolyn was a young woman, I would say about 23 or 24, and I met her in Milan. We both happened to be staying in the same hotel in Milan, a city I heartily recommend, by the way. A lot of people had said to me, oh, don't go to Milan, go right to Florence or Venice or Rome or wherever, because Milan is just a big commercial city, and I think it is one of the most wonderful cities in Italy. But anyway, that's another story. This particular hotel, when I arrived, I could barely get in the front door because there were hundreds and hundreds of bouffant bridal gowns being wheeled in and wheeled out. And it turned out that for the next 2 days, this hotel, you know, Milan is now the capital, the fashion capital of the world, having replaced Paris, that they were having this huge bridal show for buyers and people. And I mean, there were literally, I figured out that's why I got such a low rate at this hotel, because I was one of the few people who was actually staying in a room who wasn't with this contingent. And I was standing at the door one evening, looking at these wonderful bridal dresses, when this wonderful-looking young American woman with red hair, very clean-cut-looking woman in running clothes, came and stood next to me, and we sort of laughed about the bridal clothes, and it turns out she was getting married. She was on her way, as a matter of fact, to meet her spouse in Florence, or the man she was going to marry in Florence. He was a student, an art history student in Florence. And we just became friends. We palled around for the next week or so, and she was very funny. We had this thing going because people would think we were mother and daughter, and we sort of played on that. And I really enjoyed her very much, and I love that chapter because it reminds me so much of the wonderful time that we had together. Now, Vivian, the other woman you mentioned, interestingly enough, is at the other end of the scale.
Mm-hmm.
She was an older woman that I met in Venice, or she was actually with a group of people that I was traveling with in Venice. And Vivian was a writer from of women's romance stories from New York. And I felt that a woman of some wealth. And her husband had died a few years earlier, and they had traveled everywhere together. She was one of the most well-traveled women I know. And Vivian was kind of unable to enjoy anything because, whereas Carolyn enjoyed everything, and of course I did too when I was with her, Vivian was always comparing it to when she was there with her husband. And I liked her very much. She was a very interesting woman, but I could see that she was unable to break out of that. And one day we were walking around the Piazza San Marco, Vivian and I, and we came to this jewelry store that she wanted to go into, a very, very fancy jewelry store, because her husband had bought her, I can't remember whether it was coral or turquoise bracelets there, and she wanted to go and see if they had a matching set of earrings. And when we went in, she felt that the clerk was sort of blowing her off, that he was dismissing her. And I could see it upset her, because when she'd been with her husband, of course, they fawned all over her because they figured they were going to get a big sale and so forth. And when we left, it was kind of sad because she said, that's what happens when you get old and when you don't have a man. No one pays any attention to you. Now, that sounds awful, but there were other parts to her that were quite redeeming. And I remember one night she said to me when we were having dinner with several other people, all women, we were just having a great time, I thought. And as we got up to leave, she looked longingly at this table where there were two couples, and she said, now, come on, you can't tell me that you don't wish that you were here with a man. And I said, Vivian, it never crossed my mind. I've been having the best time with all of you, and it just didn't cross my mind, and it didn't. And I guess it was sort of, I felt sad for her because she could not really enjoy herself without a man. And it was a interesting encounter. But I did like her very much.
Yeah, I like her very much as well. And she was so wonderfully candid.
Yes, she was. I think that's true. And, of course, she was older. And I think, you know, everything is generational. You know, there was that book written by the Penelope Rusinoff several years ago, Why Do I Think I Am Nothing Without a Man? And I thought of that because I think women don't think of themselves that way so much anymore, although, let's face it, some still do.
Yeah. Well, she also told you that it was difficult for her to look ahead, that the future was looking a little scary.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that for someone who's not at that point yet, which I'm not, and, you know, most people I know are not. I mean, it's a little shorter distance for me than it was before, but we can't judge what that's like. Each person will have to judge that for themselves. But I do think the one other point I would like to make is there were plenty of times when I got homesick. There were plenty of times on this trip when I got lonely. And you just have to tough it out. You have to say, all right, I remember one night in Oxford, I was wandering around the streets, and it was cold and windy, and I didn't know where I was, and I was alone, and I saw this door open to this house, and all this beautiful yellow light spilled out into the darkness, and this woman came to the door, and with her cat came running up the steps and rubbed up against her legs, and I could hear her sort of, you know, talking to the cat, you know, oh, you cute little thing, and how are you, the way people do with their pets. And I felt intense loneliness. And so you have to just deal with it and get over it and know that the next day will be better, or if not the next day, the day after that.
Mm. The biographical note in the book says you've been a freelance writer since 1999, and I wonder, would that have been possible had you not made the trip you made in 1993?
Well, yeah, it would be possible for anybody to become a freelance writer, but I can tell you it is not the greatest thing in the world to be, because it means constantly hustling. I mean, if I were going to go back to doing journalism, I would go back to doing full-time journalism where I had an actual job, because freelancing is very difficult, as anyone who freelances, with the exception of, you know, some incredibly, you know, people like Dominic Dunn, who's got a gig, you know, with Vanity Fair and stuff like that. But what happened was that after I sold this book, the hardcover version, my editors and publishers really liked the book, and I had an idea immediately for a second book. And, you know, once you get one book published, it's easier to get a proposal in. And I did a two-page proposal for the second book, and they bought it the next day. So that left me with the dilemma of, how am I going to write this second book, which meant a lot of traveling, and be a full-time reporter? So I knew I had a choice to make. And it was scary. I mean, it was a risk for me. I quit my job.
Mm-hmm.
And the verdict is not in yet, quite frankly. We'll see. You know, talk to me in a year and see whether I'm, you know, trying to get handouts at the corner street somewhere on Michigan Avenue. But I just think one of the great things about life is trying something new. And I'm a curious person. And I think that people who try new things, it always involves some risk. But, you know, my brother, who's a great philosopher, said to me when I was talking it over with him, he said, look, you've had a lot of success, but you failed from the day you were born. He said, don't you remember when you first tried to walk? You didn't do it successfully. You couldn't walk. You know, I mean, he was sort of presenting all these things in life that people fail at, but then they come back and they succeed. And I just thought, I really don't want to ever feel that I've come to a stalemate. And I was beginning to feel that way. I was beginning to feel that I needed to break out a little bit. The good thing about being a writer is you can always sort of go back and do freelance work or whatever. I'm hoping, you know, not to have to do that. I'm hoping the next book will be successful. And
well, if it's as good as this one, it's a lead pipe cinch.
Thank you.
We've got to wrap it up here.
Sure.
I do want to ask you one last question. Would you mind telling us what you wrote in the postcard from Chicago?
Well, I just wrote that Chicago was a city that I didn't think I would like. I'd never been here before. But that I actually wandered around. I mean, I can't give you the exact words because I don't have it.
Yeah.
But that I spoke last night at a wonderful club called the Three Arts Club of Chicago. I don't know if you know about that, but it's a wonderful place where women artists can actually live. And I wandered around that neighborhood. I couldn't tell you what the neighborhood is at the moment. All I know is it's near what I thought would be Goethe Street, but I was told that it's pronounced totally differently here, and it has nothing to do with the writer.
Goethe.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I thought it was good. I thought it was called that because it was some very literary enclave over there. But that I actually found that there were parts of Chicago and things about Chicago that were drawing me in, and that I really did want to come back, and that, you know, that sort of surprised me a little bit. And I just wrote a little bit about having gone to see the Ansel Adams show and things like that.
Well, happy trails. We wish you the best. Thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
Alice Steinbach has been our guest this afternoon. Tonight, she'll be at Anderson's Bookstore in Naperville at 7 p.m. Anderson's is located at 123 West Jefferson Avenue. Her book, Without Reservations, The Travels of an Independent Woman, is now available in paperback from Random House.